You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for August 9th, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside Rick Santorum's YMCA shower stall, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal. Slipped that one in on me at the last minute.
Yeah. Rick Santorum says liberals make it uncomfortable to shower at the YMCA.
We do, you know.
YMCA. So, you know, he ought to know. He's got a lot of, as somebody at Crooks and Liars said,
issues.
He obsesses a lot about men taking showers.
He does. He has a lot of penis on the mind for a man who's not gay. And I don't know why he is so obsessed with other men's penises and what they're doing with those penises and whether they should be doing them or not and what Rick Santorum's policy as President Santorum would be about what those men are doing with those penises.
Well, they might be dipping them in a wine glass if they're from Australia and a conservative politician from Australia. Yeah. And taking pictures of it.
You know,
we're now finding out that all kinds of people are sexting when they shouldn't be.
Okay. He met a strange lady. He made her nervous. I can't sing
took
like
him in and gave him breakfast.
Yeah. Hey.
Hey. Hey. We got a couple letters this week. That I just want to get through real quick. One of them.
We're all done with Rick Santorum's private parts.
Oh, please.
Yeah.
We have a listener who has written to us many times. He's in the movie industry. That's all I'm going to say.
Steven Spielberg.
No. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay. Not Steven Spielberg wrote to us and said, you spoke about costume design, which we did last week.
We did, yes.
Versus special effects. Uh-huh. As a special effects artist, I can actually talk about this. Yay! The design of the suit is done by people not affiliated with costumes, so they will not qualify for the costume Oscar.
Okay.
Plus, he calls it VFX, you know, video special effects, is like the redheaded stepchild of the film industry. We get no respect and are generally ignored when we complain because we are the only big part of the film industry which isn't unionized.
Oh,
that's very interesting. That gives them the ability to ignore us. They used to work us 17 hours with below minimum wage until someone at ILM, they were paid okay, but he had a month of 17-hour days or something like that, died from it.
Oh, geez.
Then they changed by giving us free taxi service to get to work.
Yeah.
Okay.
And one way.
Services. Yeah. We still have crazy hours, and our pay isn't always fantastic, but at least we're not dying now. This is why there was a special effects protest of the Academy Awards last year, and why you will see so many special effects artists on Facebook with green icons. We're showing what movies would look like without us. They would be green screened. So to make this story short, video special effects is unlikely to get the recognition we deserve until after the film industry collapses a little while longer. Uh-huh. I think when a few more major players go bankrupt and the studios are no longer able to finish their movies, things will change. And then you might get a digital costume or digital design category at the Academy Awards. So thank you very much for all that information.
Yeah. Didn't we just catch the tail end of a documentary about casting?
We did. The casting director and what they went through in the 60s, I think it was.
And before.
And before, to get what they call a card, to get mentioned in the credits as casting director. It was a big deal. Yeah. So evolution is happening. Great.
And it happened because some very powerful person recognized how much of a debt they owed this
person. The director owed, one of the important directors recognized, I could not have made this movie without her finding the right actors for these roles. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we just saw Pacific Rim. Mm-hmm. And we saw the director on
That's what we were talking about last week about the costumes. I thought for art direction, this movie should be nominated. And the fact that it's almost all, you know, green screen done on a computer, that's unlikely to happen. But
we saw the director on The Nerdist,
Yeah, you did. I didn't watch that episode.
Well, and maybe the day will come when the person at the top of the credits came up the right way.
Yeah.
And knows how important each part of the process is. Anyway.
Right. And then we have a reader in New York State who sent us a $5 contribution. Thank you so much for that.
You can get anything read on this podcast for $5. Just so you know.
He says it, $5 for your thoughts. No, you do not. You can write to us anytime. There's no quid pro quo. But I did want to thank this person for their donation because it means a lot to us. And that's how we get to the store to get school supplies. So we're very grateful for that. I'm sure this has been used before, but help us, Obi-Wan Driftglass. You're our only hope.
Yes.
There are days that I really get depressed about our nation. Despite all the outrage at Republican conservative lawmakers, they seem to always win.
Yeah.
In Texas, we had Democrats fighting back and filibustering their draconian laws only to be voted over the following week. How is that winning? In state after state, the conservatives have voted and implemented laws to discriminate against minorities and women, taken away women's choices, and redistricted so that they essentially can run unopposed.
Uh-huh.
Please give me/us some hope that the huddled masses will be able to vote these assholes out of office and put the country back on track. Also, if Driftglass is Obi-Wan Driftglass, does that make you Princess Bluegal? No. Although there's a Photoshop out there of me as Princess Bluegal from a long time ago. Back when I was doing something for getting Wonkette to mention you for the podcast awards and doing something like help us Obi-Wan get your only hope. Yeah. So,
well, first of all, Obi-Wan doesn't get laid. So I declined in the nomination. If nominated, I shall not run. If elected, I shall not serve. Second of all, he certainly doesn't get laid with Princess Leia. So no. I don't know. I think you got to switch your metaphors around a little bit. Hope. Let's see. What do we do? What do we have on stock today? Well, let me give you the standard. There's no standard answer. I'm lying. Once upon a time, we had a civil war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And 600,000 plus Americans on both sides of the war died. The country was destroyed. The South was decimated. And the South was forced to let black people vote, among other things. And there was a brief interregnum where there were several elected representatives, lots of elected representatives from the South in Congress who were black. Mm-hmm. And they were Republicans, by the way. Yeah. This was back in the good old days when Republicans was that party.
It was
and the Democrats
were,
Democrats were the ones with the white sheets mm-hmm. and the burning crosses. Mm-hmm. And then the South regrouped and reconquered their former territories. They simply put into law that which was, they made virtual slaves of the same people who'd been actual slaves. They stripped them of voting rights, property rights. The federal government decided it wasn't worth the trouble. And for a very long time, we had a state of virtual slavery in the South. We had terrorist organizations literally running loose called the Klan, who enforced a state of feudal fascist governments, which the Southern governments were by any definition of the word, because they were in cahoots with cotton growers and landowners. It was corporations and big companies running the government. And they used murder to enforce their policy. They used terrorist tactics to keep people from bucking the system. And then the civil rights movement came along and we pushed back again. And by we, I didn't do it. I was not born
or
a baby.
Children. Yeah.
I didn't march. But I know people who did. And we pushed back and things got better. And then they pushed back and mm-hmm. things got worse, but we never reset all the way back to slavery.
Yeah.
And we never reset all the way back to Jim Crow. And right now, there's an African-American man who's the president of the United States. And that doesn't mean all of our problems went away, but it does mean that over the long arc of history, things get better, just like in the foundation.
Well, you know, and you say that, but when we watched Daily Show from last night, and Samantha Bee interviewed the black panel.
Oh, yeah.
And they talked about talking about race and the idea that, you know, how much has racism been healed on a scale of 1 to 100?
Yeah.
And all the white people said 50%, 75%.
Yeah.
And one of the African-American men said 7%, and that's Obama.
Yeah.
And he gets 7%, and that's it. And 4 out of 5 of them had been stopped and frisked. And,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, one of them said, well, you know, I just moved to New York City, so I haven't been stopped and frisked yet.
That fifth one hadn't been frisked.
He hadn't been there long enough.
Yeah.
And then the white woman said, yes, I've been stopped and frisked at the airport. Mm-hmm. What? So, you know, I see your point that Barack Obama's election is progress.
Yeah, no, I'm not, he's my cheap thumbnail example. Mm-hmm. The point I'm trying to make, I don't mean to interrupt, but the point I'm trying to make is the capacity to change things is built into the system. Mm. It can be changed. Sometimes it requires a long and bloody war. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it requires rolling federal troops into the South and making them do things. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it requires a generation of Supreme Court decisions going your way. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it requires people voting, mm-hmm, and not saying, well, fuck it, both parties are just as bad, so why even bother to vote for them?
Well, and I do think that voter suppression backfired on them very badly in 2012. And it may do so again. The crowds at Moral Monday this past week were amazingly large.
Yeah.
In North Carolina.
If only they'd been wearing tri-corner hats.
Then they would actually have people interviewing them, wouldn't they?
The right has spent a lot of time getting into the groundwater, mm-hmm, getting into the PTA level and the school board level and working their way up. Mm-hmm. While Democrats, I will paraphrase, were obsessing about primarying Obama with Dennis Kucinich.
Yep. Yep. And I was a Kucinich supporter until he decided that Ron Paul would be a good running mate when he was in New Hampshire. So,
Yeah. And we all have our stories to tell.
Yes.
Even Robert Heinlein.
No.
The most important part about becoming politically active, as a sidebar, is to find someone you're passionate about and give him or her your all. Mm-hmm. The second most important lesson is to find out the hard way that they're just human beings.
Human beings, yes.
And they break your fucking heart. Mm-hmm. They absolutely take it out of your chest and stomp.
And that's why it's really important to remember that, if you can, to remember early on that they are.
And the third most important lesson is to find a way to keep working towards the goal after that's happened to you, because it happens to everybody.
Yep. Yeah.
Or you can, you know, or you hold out for purity. You can do that. I'm not saying that's an illegitimate point of view, but you tend to not get anything done. Mm-hmm. And the problem that we on the left faced was, you know, we changed the White House. Yeah. And we did. That's great. And we put by historical standards, a center left Republican.
I argued that he was a conservative. I didn't have any illusions that
he's an Eisenhower Republican.
Yeah.
He's even a Nixon Republican.
Yeah. Yeah.
He even said
that he thought the transformative president was Reagan. So,
well, that's
before he was elected. So, yeah. You know.
And if you heard him talk in Chicago, which I did, this was all, he was always very David Brooks friendly. Mm-hmm. He was always very centrist and, can't we all get along? Can't we find common ground? Which, there's nothing, as a general way of going through life, trying to find ways to make peace is not a terrible way to go through life. But it doesn't work in politics, that especially in the politics of the United States today. Exactly right.
Yeah.
So we changed the White House. Oh, crap. Congress is still screwed up. Yeah. We forgot about Congress. And
I think we forgot about racism. I think in our lovely celebrations of, we finally got an African-American president and we have real change coming, and this is progressive to have elected a black president. Yeah. So let's be excited about that. We forgot that underneath the surface of a lot of people was white supremacy.
Yeah.
And that this country, there are large swaths of this country that are based on white supremacy and white privilege, and their politics is based on white supremacy and white privilege
and fear of black men.
People. Yep.
And that, but if you look very carefully at the playbook, it might have the Turner Diary cover, but it's the Clinton playbook.
Yeah.
He's not legitimate. I didn't vote for him. He's not a real president. Yeah. There's probably a scandal there somewhere, so we're going to keep throwing things at him to keep him off balance, keep him from governing. Mm-hmm. Even if we have to shut the government down. Yeah. We're going to talk about him and everyone like him in the most grotesque, hateful, he's a traitor, he's illegitimate, just like Gingrich taught them to do in the
90s. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we're just going to keep hammering at him and then put over that a nice thick coat of deep fear and hatred of black men, mm-hmm. especially black men. And that's what you have. That's what the Republican Party looks like. Everyone else is left.
Yeah.
But they spent 30 years digging in like ticks. Mm-hmm. And they're there to stay. The people who are making these decisions at the Republican Party level, the stuff you see, have been active members of the political class. I'm not saying they run for office, but they've been politically active for decades. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I'm sorry, but the Tea Party is not full of people who suddenly beamed in from some other planet. They're full of people who used to vote for Republicans until that got to be really embarrassing. Mm-hmm. And they scraped off their bumper stickers that said Bush Cheney, put on a bunch of tri-corner hats and said, I'm an independent.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fuck you. No, you're not. Yeah. I've seen you vote Republican for the last 25 years. They just don't want to take responsibility for doing it. But the conservative movement, the Newt Gingrich, Lee Atwater, Rush Limbaugh conservative ideological template has been mm-hmm. stamped under their heads. The good news is they're mostly old, white, and dying.
Yeah, it's sad to say that that's the good news. But there are new people coming up, and they are not going to be like this. And no. I have hope in the future of this country because of that generation.
But be prepared for different fights.
Yeah.
Be prepared for people who are fanatical, mm-hmm. laissez-faire capitalists.
Yeah.
Who believe that if you're poor and dying, screw you, that's your own problem. But who are totally cool with gay rights.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's going to happen in our lifetimes. You will see that political dynamic shift from social issues who old white church conservatives obsess over mm-hmm. to libertarian / Randite worldview of mm-hmm. survival of the fittest. And I'm the fittest.
And there's going to be people like that within our party and our midst.
Absolutely.
That we're going to have to compromise with.
Uh huh.
Oftentimes, I did want to say, you read me a comment, and I don't remember if it was at your blog or Bob Seska's blog, but your commenters and Bob Seska's commenters are both bitch about both of you at both places. So I don't know which one it was, but someone commented.
Remember, we have a ban on certain things. So.
Right. Well, no, but someone pointed out. I did want to bring this up because this is not related to a GG issue.
Yes.
Brought up that. You and I somehow should disassociate ourselves uh-huh. from those terrible people at Crooks and Liars.
Yeah. Oh, no, that
because
they're never going to. We've been de-bookmarked. I've had that mentioned to me many times in the last several weeks that I used to like you and now I no longer contribute. You've completely disappointed me. You've sold out. And
I wanted to bring up the Crooks and Liars thing because that is a group blog that I write for every night.
Uh-huh.
I do the open thread and make sure there's a music club and make sure there's my squad ground up. And that's pretty much what I do there. I don't write posts very often. And that is an example. I think I can say this without getting into trouble with anybody.
No, you can't.
With anybody there. Let me say it that way.
Okay, yeah.
That is a place where there is a variety of liberal opinion.
Oh, yeah.
There are people there that call themselves OBOTs.
Yeah.
Just as a joke. But, you know, I should write that post because an OBOT should write that post because it's critical of Obama. If people see that the OBOT is writing something critical of Obama, they'll pay more attention. And then you have other people there who are writing pro Glenn Greenwald posts, anti-Obama posts, very angry with the president about X, Y, and Z. And
everything in between.
Everything in between. And we get along. And we get along because we know at the end of the day, because, you know, the former RNC chair always says that. I'm not going to say that.
Yeah.
What's his name again?
Ken Melman or Michael Steele?
Michael Steele always says at the end of the day.
Uh-huh. Well, it's sad that you know that.
Yeah, constantly. We know that when it comes down to things like the XL pipeline or who should be president of the United States in the end, in the general election, we're going to be on the same side. And that keeps us, and we have a common goal of getting the blog done every day, too. And it's the fact that there are posts there that I disagree with in detail.
Vehemently.
In detail, well, and in, yeah. and in the details of. I just disagree with the details of the opinion there. I still have great respect for them. And tonight's open thread, we're recording this on Wednesday, but tonight's open thread I put up as an example to all of us. It's a video of Johnny Rotten reviewing a video of Katy Perry, of all things. Here is Johnny Rotten looking at Katy Perry's biopic on his computer and talking about it. And if you think about musical styles and polar opposites, and he could have just said, fuck this, this is terrible crap, and there's no revolution in this, or whatever. He really talks about her like she's a human being. And says she's got clever costumes, but they're not sexual, and they're saucy, and he just goes on and he talks about her hair, and I could give her advice on hair products, and I could.
Yeah.
And then there's a clip of her father, who I don't need to get into all of the detail, but you know, he's a minister and has a huge cross around his neck, and he looks at Katy Perry's father and says, "Oh, you poor girl."
Yeah.
Oh, you grew up with this. Okay. That helps me understand a lot of things. And he is just so not wanting to trash her as a person.
Yeah.
Even though he would never participate in a Katy Perry concert or, you know, in any way endorse that kind of music as art.
But they're in the same club, in a sense.
The same business, yeah.
Exactly. They've been on stage. They know what that's like. They've toured. They know what that's like. Yep. They've had people adore them and hate them.
Yep.
They've probably, you know, had problems.
Yep.
And that only they could talk to each other about.
Yeah. Yep.
And
that's us as liberals.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that's us as liberals. And so I really appreciated his maturity and how... You know, the persona that you think of with Johnny Rotten is, and I'm not going to say he's mellowed, because I don't think he's mellowed all that much, although he does advertise. You know, he's doing things for money now to earn retirement money, because doing butter advertising in England and so forth. But I was impressed. I was impressed with his maturity and humanity in talking about her. So changing subjects. I'm going to do a little rant now, if you don't mind.
Please clear the decks. About what?
Money.
Money.
Because I have been disgusted this week with how the word million has been tossed around when it comes to Jeff Bezos buying the Washington Post, and he bought it for $250 million. And that is discussed in the news media, in the Beltway Press, as if it's not a real number. And jokes are made about how, you know, that's the change in his golf club bag, and that this is now his play toy. The Washington Post is now his play toy. And all of the navel gazing that's going on in the Beltway media about, is it worth it? Was it worth it? What are we worth? You know, and that kind of crap. Then I see that at Wonkette that Mitt Romney was on the Today Show. Why? I don't know. But... Did you know that Mitt Romney is concerned about the growing wealth gap?
I imagine he would be.
And Wonkette said,
between what? Between
millionaires and billionaires?
Yeah, I was going to say, between millionaires and billionaires, that's a tough crowd.
Wonkette said, a rising elevator lifts all cars. So he expressed concern about that post-election, this is an area of concern for him. Business Week magazine announced that the median price for a two-bedroom apartment in Manhattan is now $1.35 million for a two-bedroom apartment. John Oliver did a wonderful thing showing that, and maybe this was last week, maybe we discussed this last week too, about
the woman saying that minimum wage, the woman on Fox who said, oh, minimum wage, you know, you just need to work your way up and pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But then when it comes to tax cuts, $250,000 in New York City is poverty.
Yeah, that's practically poverty.
Practically poverty.
Yeah. Yeah.
Barack Obama announced on Wednesday that he would increase support for people affected by the Syria conflict by more than $196 million.
Uh-huh.
See, he could have taken that money and bought the Washington Post if he'd been willing to bargain with Jeff Bezos. I'm glad he's doing that. If you look at the pictures of what's going on in Syria and the refugees there, they're really bad off. And they need, this is humanitarian aid. He says the new aid is food assistance, medical supplies, hygiene kits, clothing, household goods for war victims, and $41 million in just food to refugees in Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, Iraq, and Egypt. So, yeah, good for him, you know? But then don't tell me we don't have money for Head Start. I am to the point where we don't have money for Head Start.
What we need to do is is declare childhood another country.
Well,
and then treat it as foreign aid.
A commenter at Wonka, or treat it as military aid.
Yeah, well,
I mean, as if a Wonka commenter said, about the Mitt Romney story, finish your lobster. There are children in China. I mean, America, who are going hungry. And, you know, we're cutting food stamps, for God's sakes. I'm so mad. I'm so mad at this country and its priorities. And don't get me started about baseball players, all right? I mean, just don't. The coverage of the whole A-Rod story and some sports commentator saying, well, you know, the question is he going to leave $90 million on the table or only two?
Uh-huh. That's an important question, Blue Gal.
What about the cyclist who, you know, oh, all of his Tour de France trophies were taken away from him. But, you know, he's still better off than he was before he won any of those prizes. And doping was worth it to him.
Sure. It was cost benefit
of
doping.
It was. Totally is. And I don't, at this point, I don't understand why they just don't make it like Pacific Rim. You know, just let them dope the fuck out of themselves. Let them until they kill themselves.
That's a Saturday Night Live, you know, it's the all drug Olympics. Just do whatever you want. Well, that's because of history. Because at least in, especially baseball, stats go back over a century.
Yeah. Okay. So it's
so you want to be able to compare. But at the end of the day, this is part of the problem with being a nerd. I never played Little League baseball, but I played baseball. I played sandlot baseball. I like baseball. I like shooting baskets. I can stand in the middle of the court and block shots. And I played volleyball and I run track. I've had sports experience.
Mm-hmm.
I can score a game. I can't box score a game because that code just screws me up. I never learned how to do that.
Well, it's absolutely like programming. It's a skill. That's a real mathematic skill. Yeah.
Yeah. And some people have it and some people don't. Mm-hmm. The college I went to did not have a football team or a basketball team or a baseball team. So I have no sitting in meetings as I did as a grown up, listening to grown men talk about their alma maters, which they had not seen for 20 years this weekend. I understand school pride and I understand college sports and that's fine. But when baseball, football, and basketball became business,
mm-hmm.
and the owners became completely consumed with maximizing profit.
But see, that happened at exactly the same time that the media became business and politics became business. And it's a generational thing.
Well, let me draw one important distinction.
Mm-hmm.
Politics gets people killed.
Mm-hmm.
The media, I depend on, even the bad media, I depend on for my information about the world around me.
Mm-hmm.
Sports is a game.
Yeah.
It's an important game and it's an admirable game. And watching good athletes, great athletes do what they do at the top of their career. I was in Chicago during Michael Jordan's heyday. Mm-hmm. I watched the Bulls. I enjoyed the Bulls. I've been to many Cubs games. I've enjoyed watching athletes on the field. But the idea that grown men jerk off by the million to the most minute aspects of what is a game and really worry about it and really argue about it and really get very upset if you don't understand their vocabulary or don't care.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. Go off and do that over there. Mm-hmm. But it's a game. And the fact that the game is now dominated by people who want to win because the money involved is so huge.
Yeah.
They cheat is not exactly a surprise to anyone who's studied human nature for more than 4 minutes.
And there's a wonderful chapter in Chris Hayes' book about doping that relates it to this whole political thing of cheating. Yeah, yeah.
We've made the rewards for the top end so gargantuan and completely out of proportion with any sort of sane idea of what national priority should be.
Right.
That you made it inevitable people would look for an edge.
Yeah. But that's kind of where I am right now, is adequate compensation for everyone. And there's just no there. We talk about wealth inequity, and it's really easy for somebody like Mitt Romney to say, you know, the wealth disparity is sort of a problem.
Yes.
No, you know what the problem really is? Concentration of wealth is the problem. The problem is, Mitt Romney, is that you have too much damn money.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to redistribute that.
We used to do with a very weighted tax code.
Yep.
That's
how I feel about it. And I did want to, I mean, this is sad to me, but in contrast, and I don't hold myself up to these women at all, but Amanda, Gina, and Michelle, who are the three women who were held in Ariel Castro's basement for 10 years, or in his house. That house was demolished this week.
Yeah.
The police went over it with a fine-tooth comb. There are photographs of the house on the web, which are just dreadful. I mean, I looked at them, but I had to just close the tab. I couldn't look anymore. There was a washing machine in the basement that had $22,000 in cash hidden inside the washing machine.
Uh-huh.
And the authorities offered the money to these three women. And they all three of them gave them the choice, and they all three turned it down. And they would rather have it go back to the community. They decided together that they would like to donate it to the community.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you compare that to a $90 million doping baseball player, and, you know, like I said, I don't hold myself up to these women at all. I think that is incredibly noble of them and so forth. But, you know, you and I had to do a financial statement for the state of Illinois this week.
Yes. Yes.
The state of Illinois is culling down their Medicaid rolls.
Uh-huh.
And I think we will be fine. But we had to do a financial statement, and one of the things I had to do as part of the financial statement was go through our PayPal records and look in greater detail at who donates to us and actually do an accounting statement for the state of Illinois. And I'm so grateful for all of the donations that come in. But really, it is 1% of our listeners that donate anything. Yeah. And some donate more than $5 and some donate $5 a month. And, so, you know, there's a variety of amounts, and we're so grateful for every dollar. And it's a miracle every time it happens. But you will find, and I say this about any charity that you believe in, and I don't consider myself a charity case, but anything you believe in, don't count on someone else to do it, because you know, Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, and is a charity that I believe in, or a cause that I believe in. Habitat for Humanity is another cause that I believe in. And I believe in the mission work, the local mission work that our church does to feed and clothe the homeless. And they also do a lot of work with at-risk poverty youth at our church and make sure they have school supplies. It's underwear month this month at our church. We're giving clean, brand new packages of underwear because these kids come to school, and that is something they don't have, is clean underwear. Amazing.
Our atheist listeners should know that a substantial chunk of your money ends up in the hands of
No, but I do make sure that I don't even tithe. We take care of home first, but I do buy a package of underpants when I do my back to school shopping and make sure that a child that doesn't have underpants to wear to school has underpants. And I can make sure one child has that.
Yeah.
You know, and, besides my own.
And when and that same 1% you'll find in every organization, or 20% or 10%.
That's what I mean to say.
And yeah.
I don't consider myself or this podcast undersupported because 1% give. I just want everyone to be aware that the causes that you believe in and the things that you believe in that you want to see go on, and we should mention Liberal Oasis in that regard.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Let's pause for a moment and mention that.
Liberal Oasis is a fellow podcasters who were, and I have to say it in the past tense, which breaks my heart, a fantastic podcast. And Bill Scherr and Tracy Lynn were podcasted for years. I mean, they did hundreds of episodes, and they stopped in July. And I don't think they necessarily stopped for financial reasons. Bill Scherr put up on his last, they did a very short, he did a very short thing. Tracy got a job that required much more of her time than allowed her to continue to podcast. And Bill Scherr works for Campaign for America's Future. So he's got a full-time job, and he's going to continue to do his Talking Heads thing with Matt Lewis. So they, he does a, I'm not going to call it Both Sides Now, but he does a liberal and conservative show with Matt Lewis. So, so he's, they're not, you know, disappearing from the
universe. Earth. Yeah.
But I'm going to miss that podcast.
Yeah.
And so I'm, all I'm saying is, if there's something out there that you believe in or that you think needs support, don't leave it to someone else. And I always say this, if you're unemployed, this is our gift to you. But if you're the kind of person who goes out and buys a Starbucks or a caffeinated beverage at a drive-thru, buy one for us. If you have that, if you have that much disposable income. We appreciate it. All right. I didn't mean to get off on a fundraiser. You know, as I've said before, August is a terrible month to fundraise.
It is.
No, it everybody's getting ready for back to school. Stuff we are sick and tired of talking about.
Yeah.
Anthony Weiner.
Yeah.
The GOP clown car. I am already done with that metaphor. Period. Yeah. Done. I mean,
because it's a TARDIS. It's got infinite capacity. It just is.
It's always bigger on the inside.
It has so much room in there, and it's so full, and it gets worse and worse and crazier. So.
And we're already talking about it.
Yeah, but no, we're not. We're just
a crowded field for Iowa. Why?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Why? Donald Trump played golf with the Speaker of the House this week.
Yeah, let's just move right on past. Let's do like Peggy Noonan, just tiptoe right.
We really can't talk about that because that's like torture. Yeah. It's just too unpleasant.
Some things you just need to tiptoe past.
And Glenn Greenwald. And you and I have a disagreement as to whether Glenn Greenwald should be discussed on our podcast.
I think I'll pass.
Okay.
I think I'll pass.
I talk about it. Maybe I won't be so irritated. You and Bob Seska and Charlie Pierce, all three of you, and congratulations, by the way, Drift Class, on getting linked at Charlie Pierce today, Wednesday.
It cost me a fortune, Blue Gown.
No, it didn't.
Charlie Pierce was good enough to link to me today.
He was good enough to link to you today, and that's very nice.
Leading ever more people to my site who then disown me.
Then just hate you. Okay. But all three of you, and I'm just going to lump you together as the triumvirate of evil people who hate freedom.
The only three people who hate freedom.
You guys have pointed out, to put it kindly, some factual inconsistencies.
Yes.
In some of the things, some of the actual critical statements that are critical to his argument that Glenn Greenwald has said.
Yes.
Glenn Greenwald is lying about important things on which he actually hangs his arguments.
Since I'm not prepared to talk about this subject, it's...
yes, you are.
Let's just say you and I were having an argument about, I don't know, the mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
You have a legitimate point of view, and I have a point of view I think is legitimate. So, you know, we're having an argument about the mortgage. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of that argument, I say, well, of course you'd say that because you murdered my mother. And in the middle of a
sitting right over.
And my mother's fine. And she hasn't been murdered. And you keep insisting, no. Every time we have this discussion, you kill my mother. No, that's, you know, I might be wrong. I'm perfectly willing to admit that I might be wrong about this. But at no point in time have I killed your mother or you killed mine, because that's crazy. Because here's the physical evidence that never happened. Mm-hmm. And that's
it is the totally unfair fight between married people is what's going on here.
You never, and
all of those triggering words that shut down debate, which is, as we've said many times, a very good thing to do in a court of law.
Sure.
But when you're a journalist actually trying to find a kernel of truth.
When you're a journalist who said repeatedly that all you want to do is start a debate.
Yeah.
And you do everything you can to shut down.
And you want to do it without rancor.
Yes. And then you say,
they always, and they never.
You killed my mother. And that's the thing about those kind of attacks is you can call me a jerk and a dupe and whatever you want. That's fine. It's, you know, that's the problem with this particular kind of journalism is it, somebody else pointed out, it grew up fighting people on the internet.
Yeah.
So that this kind of writing does not understand the distinction between writing the story and calling someone an asshole and a fucker and a troglodyte and a goat fucker in the middle of it. You know, I don't remember.
Or if your opponent is a woman, threatening to rape them with Twitter on Twitter, which is another issue altogether. But since we're talking about internet discourse, Twitter needs to clean up their act. I just want to say that.
Okay. And certain people who want to be taken seriously as journalists need to stay the hell off of Twitter.
Yeah.
When talking about the story they're working on.
Glenn Greenwald never threatened to rape anyone. I'm not.
No, he did not.
But there are many people who have gone after women journalists on Twitter and in very awful ways. And that needs to stop. And and the way that needs to stop is at the management level of Twitter.
Needs to
ban these IP addresses.
But if the person making the ludicrous and factually untrue accusations, like all whistleblowers are shipped off to Supermax prisons and held incommunicado forever.
Yeah.
Because that's what always happens to whistleblowers in the United States. Except it's never happened to whistleblowers in the United States, not even fucking close.
Yeah.
And you say that on the Twitter, and then you go on television, say it again, and then you go on another television program and say it a third time. Here's the problem. You've now crossed a line between picking up whatever is handy to beat the crap out of your opponent because you are a very, very angry person and you only know how to respond to criticism or to questions by calling someone a traitor and a dupe. That's one thing. But now you've gone and lied.
Yep.
And you've lied repeatedly and on the air, and you've done it as a journalist. And you're on the record in a long, clear record that says people who – journalists who do even a fraction of this – need to be held to account. And so I said, look, whatever you think of this story, and I think it's an important story, it's a consequential story, the story of NSA surveillance and the story of the FISA court being inadequate or corrupted or toothless or whatever.
There's a large segment of the liberal blogosphere that never heard you say that and never will.
Except I say it in every post I write.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Because you
hate. There are commenters who will just never
acknowledge
that you say that.
And they come winging in and call me everything, as they say, but a child of God, which I moderate my comments. I let all that in because I think it's a valuable public service to say, do you notice how nobody is actually reacting to what I wrote? They are really angry that I wrote it. Therefore, they are calling me everything but a child of God. But nobody will actually engage on the level that I'm writing about, which is here's this actual thing that happened in this really important story that the reporter who's reporting on this really important story really did in the real world. Isn't that a shame? And isn't that irresponsible and reckless? And by the way, this same reporter demands that other journalists be held accountable for their shit. So why aren't you, you know, or maybe you're just G-bots.
Now we're name calling.
I shouldn't do that. I want to say that I spent enough time writing about Glenn Greenwald that people begged me to write about David Brooks.
Good. And you did a new Photoshop, too.
I did.
You didn't recycle one of your old Photoshops, although they are all very good.
I do have a large portfolio of art that I try to do to accompany stories. But yeah, I did a brand new Photoshop, and it was about the fact that David Brooks took the A-Rod controversy and turned it into a story about his rise, you know, David Brooks's rise to humbleness.
Humbleness, yes. His and humility. How he found humility at the end of a $4 million house.
And it basically boiled down to, I used to worry about what critics said about me. I was kind of obsessed over, you know, external validation for what I was writing. But I don't do that anymore.
No, because you have a paycheck to validate who you are. Yeah, okay. Well,
and it's one thing if you don't care about what your critics say and you're writing about, I don't know, television reviews or something that's relatively trivial. But David Brooks has a very impressive, long track record about being horribly wrong about everything.
Yes, he does.
His reaction to being really, really wrong about really dangerous big things and loudly wrong, consistently wrong, repeatedly wrong, at the top of the journalistic pyramid, being able to be wrong on three news sources at once. His reaction to that is never to acknowledge he was ever wrong, never to acknowledge he ever said anything about it, never to acknowledge it ever happened, never to apologize, and just move on to the next thing he's wrong about. And in that way, he retains what he calls his psychic equilibrium and won't end up like A-Rod using apparently performance-enhancing juice to make his sentences better because he's also a pretty bad writer. I usually leave David Brooks on the table these days because between Matt Taibbi and Charlie Pierce, they sort of do that. But this one was just so how I had to learn as David Brooks not to really react to my critics and listen to external voices, just to let my message come through and let my, wow, he said again from the vast spaces of his $4 million home. Yes. So
you wrote in our podcast notes that Reince Priebus is a dick.
Yes.
But I think he's a pussy.
Yeah, well.
And I think that because this whole idea of complaining about a movie that's going to be on CNN.
Yes. At some
point. About Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
Really makes you look weak, in my personal opinion. It just seems like you're really trying to precede the field, and I don't understand that. But
well, if I were Reince Priebus, I'd be hugely offended by science fiction channels planning to run Flowers for Algernon during the during the Republican convention.
The Reince Priebus story, yeah. Flowers for Algernon.
Wow. He's
less intelligent every day. Yeah.
Watching an entire party get stupider every day. But he apparently never read it, so that's not really a problem. But he knows who Hillary Clinton is.
Yeah.
She's the person who's probably going to kick his ass in 2016.
Yeah.
Although, nothing's set in stone.
One of our listeners sent both of us an interview that Cenk Uygur did with Reza Aslan. And we kind of skipped over the Fox News interview with Reza Aslan. I don't think we talked too deeply about it. Reza Aslan is the author of a book that I haven't read yet, but I plan to read, called Zealot, which is about, from what I understand, and as again, I haven't read it, but the focus of this book is the political time in which Jesus existed, because there is lots and lots of evidence about the way Romans behaved. And Reza Aslan tends to extrapolate from that this Jewish illiterate leader, through his charisma, he says that in interviews, through his charisma actually founded a movement that eventually became Christianity. And I did find it interesting. Cenk Uygur is a good interviewer, a good liberal, and also an agnostic. And he had interesting things to say about his mom and her religiosity in this interview, which we will link at our Facebook page. And thank you to the listener who sent it to us. I found it, however, to be, while it was much more in-depth and Cenk Uygur allowed Reza Aslan to answer the questions and to talk about his book, unlike the Fox News interviewer just kept going on about for 20 minutes about him being Islamic. The fact that so much of what Cenk Uygur was saying was, well, I'm an agnostic and you haven't proven to me that any of this ever happened.
Right.
Really, I think, missed the point. And I was glad that Reza Aslan pushed back on that and said, not only did that not matter to the people in Jesus' time and who were telling this story to make a point about truth, not to tell the truth. There's a difference. But you're ignoring what happened since then. You know, that there actually is this movement called Christianity that for terrible evil and some good, hopefully the good will eventually outweigh the bad. I get it. I get those people who have just had it with religion. Trust me, I get it. That so much awful politics and so much evil in the history of the world has been done in the name of religion. But the fact is, we still have Christian churches thousands of years later. Uh-huh. And as a historian, that matters.
And people struggling with how to live a good life.
Yeah, well, that to me, too, is the fascinating part about all of these interviews that he's doing, is that, you know, you can say, well, it just doesn't matter because it didn't happen. But then you have this guy on your show and talk to him for 25 minutes about how you feel about Jesus.
Uh-huh. And,
and it does matter to everyone how you, even rejecting the existence of Jesus, if you want to say that and go that far, you're still passionate about that. And the passion that is elicited by this, as Risa Aslan points out, this guy from the hill countries, you know, uh-huh. he was not from Rome. He was not from an important family.
No.
He was not from money. He might have been,
but that wasn't in the interview.
That wasn't in Risa Aslan's book.
No.
Yeah, you're thinking of Gnostic Gospels and so forth.
Yeah. But just strictly from the point of view of the information available during the interview.
Yeah. Yeah. That this guy elicits passions in people one way or the other. And that makes it worth talking about.
And that's the point of, I hate to say this, the point of going to divinity school.
Which Risa Aslan and I both went to the same divinity.
You both did. So you're just sucking up. Harvard friggin' alum.
I'm going to look that up while you're talking.
Yeah. I did a little time with the Jesuits at Loyola, just a little bit. But point of the conversation that was most interesting was how much Mr. Uger wanted this to be a discussion of a history book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And its complete failure as history. And Mr. Aslan trying to explain to him that none of this was written as history. This is written as metaphor, parable. It was written as a lot of literature was at the time, to make not a legally binding case in a court of law,
mm-hmm.
but to, you know, and here are the facts of the case, sir. It was designed to make a metaphorical, prophetic argument that, like Moses, this is what he did. And like David, this is what he did. And like Joseph, he too went to Egypt. Did he ever go to Egypt? Probably not. But the idea was to take the palette of the literature that had existed up until that point and remix it and repaint it in such a way that this portrait slowly emerges as literally hundreds of years pass and the stories keep changing depending on the person you're marketing to and what the core of believers believe. And it is as futile as saying, but Moby Dick never existed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course not. It's a work of fiction. But what we think of fiction is something that's purely imaginative, that was invented by somebody, that has no relationship with the real world, but has a metaphorical meaning that resonates with human condition. But biblical literature is supposed to resonate with the human condition and be as metaphorical as all that, but it's supposed to be loosely based on some guy who lived and died at a certain place and time.
Mm-hmm.
But it was never intended to be the literal and inerrant word of God. It was never intended to be the literal history of what happened. If it were, it would fail immediately. If you want the literal history of what happened, go, you know, check out. Romans kept really good notes.
Yeah, well, they did. Yeah.
Go check that out. But that.
You know who else kept really good notes? Nazis.
Nazis, that's right. That's right. So there you go.
Risa Aslan has exactly the same degree from Harvard that I do.
Uh-huh.
And this is really depressing. He was born in 1972. So he's 10 years younger than we are.
Well,
so.
And he, you know, well, what do you want? He was born.
He was also in the Iowa Writers' Workshop after that.
That
so,
explains a lot.
Yeah, it does. It also explains his attitude towards storytelling. And his patience in interviews with getting the point across.
How to survive in a Shark Tank. A,
yeah.
Go to the Iowa Workshop.
Writer's Workshop.
Survive. B, you can handle anything.
Anything after that.
Six people sitting around calling you a talentless hack. Yeah, screw it. What do you people know?
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. Each week we post to our website and Facebook page an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's kitty is Annie. She does not like the paparazzi. She is a camera shy kitty, or else she's just sleeping with her paw over her face. But you don't get to see Annie's whole face. You're not entitled to that. No.
Don't look directly at her.
You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, or you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service, Go Postal Unions, letter on the air, unless you say otherwise.
So, Blue Gal, how are the internet kitties doing this week?
Well, the internet kitties are actually deeply offended that I called Reince Priebus a pussy.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-dovey. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with a switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2013, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
All right, Sam, our listener Sam. Hello, Sam.
Hello, Sam.
Has a very open-ended sci-fi question for you.
Okay.
Or SF question. Is there a parallel between the West Wing for political fiction and the Twilight Zone for science fiction? And to me, that's like, you're just opening a door for Driftglass to talk for 3 hours. You realize that, right?
I used to give a 7-hour lecture on this at the TED Talks. Yes and no. I didn't hear this question before, Sam, so I'm thinking on my feet here, but I have to say yes and no. No, to the extent that the West Wing was about the West Wing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a direct, you know, this was the acting president, as we used to joke. This was the liberal president we dreamed of, and it had imaginary Republicans. It had people who were based on real people. Josh Lyman was based on Rahm Emanuel, according to legend, and that wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. But it had a real look and feel of the actual operating of the government. It had Lawrence O'Donnell working on it and Dee Dee Myers, so you could get a real fingertip sense of what it felt like to be in the West Wing of the White House and trying to do the business of governing. It was also trying to parallel things that happened or were happening or they thought should happen in the real world. There was a presidential crisis involving a secret that got out, so that was their Whitewater. But the Twilight Zone was explicitly set up by Rod Serling because he couldn't tell the stories he wanted to tell on network television.
Hmm.
He tried in the arena. I actually wrote about this a little while ago. I hope I hit publish on that damn thing. If I didn't, I really should go back and hit publish. I have a lot of stuff in draft form. There was a show especially, two of them as I recall. One was called A Town Has Turned to Dust, which was supposed to be about the lynching of Emmett Till. The murder of Emmett Till.
Yeah.
And
a very political story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
John Frankenheimer, I think, was the director. Mm-hmm. You know, these are the glory days of television. This is the days of live television and you had people like Pat Ichaevsky working in television. So one of the big guns in that world was Rod Serling before the Twilight Zone. He was writing Playhouse 90 stuff and he was acclaimed and powerful and famous writer. The only writer that anybody knew anything about was Rod Serling.
Well, and these were the days of television before we realized that people will watch anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And there were three channels and people actually tried to put high quality.
They did.
Opera was on television. There was a sense of this new technology really needs to be used for the public good and to better people.
And there was a sense that the news division should lose money.
Yeah.
Because it's supposed to be the public service end of your business.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, that conflict between commerce and art was what led to the demise of live playwright television.
Mm-hmm.
The live part was very exciting because actors could screw up all the time. And, you know, you were literally sprinting from set to set. So there was a certain element of danger to it. But part of the problem was that the sponsors, the people who paid for the airtime, had more and more control over content.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that used to screw up Rod Serling and mess him up, imagine a network person, a writer saying this, I can't work on this because breaking up my story every 20 minutes for a toilet paper ad.
Every 8 minutes.
Ruins the dramatic arc of the story. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I just can't do it.
Right.
That was the kind of argument he was having in the 50s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So sponsors were very, very uncomfortable with anything that was, see if this sounds familiar, controversial.
Yes.
And hearkening back to, I'm a little bit of bleed over from.
Well, you know, Emmett Till, we need to discuss both sides.
Well, we don't. Now you've ruined the end of my story. No, you really haven't. But the first one was, I'm not sure chronologically, but one of the first one was, we need to dramatize this incredibly important moment in American history and this sort of larger civil rights struggle.
Yeah.
And sponsors would, fuck that. We're not doing that. Are you crazy? Yeah. So it ended up being about a Mexican town and people wearing masks and a lynching.
Mm-hmm.
The guy was dragged out of jail and lynched. It was technically a mob and was involved. And there was a lynching, but had absolutely nothing to do with the subject matter because the sponsors were not going to have it.
Yep.
And they just sort of said, no, we're not going to permit you to put this on the air. But the arena was the more interesting one. The arena was Rod Serling wanted to tell a story about, I don't know, trade tariffs or something very West Wing-ish. Mm-hmm. And the sponsors... See if this reminds you of any programs like, oh, let's say Meet the Press. The sponsors were so terrified of causing any controversy that they wouldn't let you mention the name of a political party or the actual name of any business being done in front of Congress.
Wow. Yeah.
So you had made up political parties arguing over made up issues because both sides.
Yeah.
Because if you wanted to tell a story about how the Democrats in the 1950s or early 60s were stalling civil rights legislation, which did happen.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you wanted to tell a story about Republicans doing something, you couldn't do that.
No, you had to do Star Wars One with Obi-Wan Kenobi talking about trade routes.
Exactly.
And exactly. Then no one knows what you're talking about.
What in the God's name are you talking about? Because you had Rod Serling with a script that had Democrats and Republicans on a real issue. And the sponsors saying, oh, screw that.
Yeah.
That'll piss off half of our – no matter what you do, half our audience will hate us. So you cannot talk about the real politics of real people and real political parties and what they really think in a dramatic form on television, period,
mm-hmm.
No matter how big a shot you are. And so, first of all, jump forward 50 years. That is exactly the business model that Meet the Press builds itself on. Half the media builds itself on. Don't offend anyone.
Right.
Make sure you always fault both sides for everything. And it's become part of our culture. And way too many people's reflex, especially when they're conservative, you tell them something awful that some Republican has done, their immediate reflex is, yeah, but the Democrats, yeah, but the liberals. So we joke about that almost every week on this podcast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But its roots go way back and they have to do with commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And so to tell the stories he wanted to tell, Rod Serling had to tell them in a parable form. So instead of black and white Americans, we'll have Martians do it. And instead of it happening now, it'll happen 20,000 years from now. And that's the way he got away with telling stories about McCarthyism. Because the Monsters Are Due on Maple Street is about McCarthyism.
Mm-hmm.
Period. I mean, it's about ideas killing people. And fear being used to exploit people. And it's explicitly about McCarthyism, but he never uses the word McCarthy. He has aliens
mm-hmm.
show up in a mm-hmm. typical U.S. city, a typical little town, and screw with people's technology. And they turn on each other and they kill each other. Sorry for the spoiler. I didn't mean to do that.
That's
but
all right.
It's precisely because he could not talk about what the West Wing talked about every week that he had to resort to telling it in a science fiction venue, which turned out to be brilliant because there were such good stories and they were timeless. The best of them are really timeless. They will last 100 years.
You want to add anything about Game of Thrones to that discussion?
Oh, good books.
And actually, that brings us back to we want to thank very much one of our listeners named Andrew.
Thank you, Andrew.
Yeah, Andrew gave us a gift certificate that he had earned.
Uh-huh.
From Oxford University Press, he wrote a encyclopedia entry for them. And I know from my ex-husband's experience that that can pay pretty well, but oftentimes you get paid in books. And Andrew wrote to me for my birthday and said, I don't need any more books. And I thought, really? You know, because we're kind of in that boat too. But he had this gift certificate, for Oxford and said, why don't you spend it? And I'll get with a publisher and make sure that the books get sent to you. And I thought, oh, that's wonderful. Thank you.
And one of the books that I ordered, several of them have arrived already. And one of the books that I ordered with you in mind, Driftglass, is the Oxford Book of Science Fiction Stories.
Uh-huh.
And some of these books, some of the books in the Oxford University Press catalog are academic textbooks that are, you know, $300 a piece. But this one is a paperback. It's 1995 USA list price. And thank you, Andrew, by the way.
Yeah. Thank
we would
you so
never
much.
Have we would not have this book if it weren't for you. But you and I were talking about it, and I thought we would have a little discussion about, first of all, the stories that are in it.
Uh-huh.
And the reasoning behind Tom Shippey, Shippey, S-H-I-P-P-E-Y. He is the editor. He seems to have selected these stories as a kind of chronological review of science fiction, starting with H.G. Wells in 1903 and moving through cyberpunk. The last story is Piecework by David Brin in 1990, yeah. And then he stops. But we were kind of surprised, both of us, that there's no Asimov in here.
Yep.
What else is missing?
No Heinlein.
No Heinlein.
No Philip Dick,
right.
No Harlan Ellison, no Kurt Vonnegut.
Right. And that might have been a matter of permissions, we were thinking.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Easily. Could have been a lot of different things.
Because a lot of people are included. You mentioned the story from 1955, The Tunnel Under the World by Frederick Pohl.
Yeah.
As being a good early story. If someone is introducing themselves to science fiction, that's a good story to start with. There's also Larry Niven, Ursula K. Le Guin, Arthur Clarke.
I'm going to read this book because it points out the number of – there's just so many short stories and so many novels. And there's a bunch in here by authors I know, but I didn't read this particular story or didn't remember it. I don't remember it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So I'm going to thoroughly enjoy this.
We wanted to thank Andrew. And also I want to just mention in the opening paragraph of the introduction, the reasoning behind his selection of these stories was fascinating.
Yeah.
He says, and I'm just going to read a few sentences, a revealing way of describing science fiction is to say that it is part of a literary mode which one may call, and I'm going to mispronounce this, is it fabril?
I'm guessing it is.
Fabril is the opposite of pastoral. But while the pastoral is an established and much discussed literary mode, recognized as such since early antiquity, its dark opposite has not yet been accepted or even named by the lawgivers of literature. Yet the opposition is a clear one. Pastoral literature is rural, nostalgic, conservative. It idealizes the past and tends to convert complexities into simplicity. Its central image is the shepherd. Fabril literature, of which science fiction is now by far the most prominent genre, is overwhelmingly urban, disruptive, future-oriented, eager for novelty. Its central image is the Faber, the smith or blacksmith in older usage, but now extended in science fiction to mean the creator of artifacts in general, metallic, crystalline, genetic, or even social. So he takes the argument that a science fiction story is the opposite of a pastoral story. It is a fabril story, and his selections reflect that. And I thought that was an interesting way of thinking
about it. That's a useful way of categorizing it. I could be an academic jerk and point out the exceptions, because that's what you do in three-hour writing classes.
Can you give, off the top of your head, I'd be really impressed if you can give me some examples of pastoral science fiction.
I can't think of any pure pastoral science fiction. I can think of, like, The End of Eternity, where the idea is to make the world peaceful by removing technology from it.
Mm-hmm.
But technology is still at the center of it. I guess I'd class something like the middle portion, the early and middle portion of A Canticle for Leibovitz, which is a post-apocalyptic story.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a post-apocalyptic story in which the only thing that survives is the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts off in the Dark Ages.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the sort of the march of civilization back from complete obliteration. But I think that's a really good point. I can think of places in particular stories where a science fiction author put a technology-free planet.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can argue alternate histories or things like that don't use technology.
Mm-hmm.
and therefore they are not, but they do. I mean, The Guns of the South is not a pastoral book, but it was set in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's a very, very good science fiction story. It's also a really good story about the Civil War. So I would tend to say, generally speaking, that's a really good broad category of that. It is forward looking. The whole question of science fiction comes down to what if, and what if is almost inherently a future looking question as opposed to a nostalgic backward looking question. So I would have, if my grade depended on it, I could come up with some really shitty examples of why you're not entirely right, man. You don't know what you, but broadly speaking, I could teach this course and I would have no trouble doing it with a straight face.
I guess the other thing that comes into the discussion, though, is the issue of domesticity in science fiction.
Yeah.
And women's writing having more domestic details than men's science fiction writing often. I'm thinking of contrasting, for instance,
yeah,
a book like the one we're listening to right now,
yeah,
which is The Foundation by Isaac Asimov.
Written for 14-year-old boys.
Yeah. And contrasting that with Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale.
Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, we're listening to this book written by Asimov, and oftentimes two men will be discussing the future of trade or the future of war or the future of something, and you really have no idea where they are sitting talking. There's no discussion of the chair they're sitting in. Yep. Are they sitting at a desk, in an office, in a conference room, in a black spaceship? You don't have any sense of where are they and who's taking care of their needs. No one delivers dinner. You know, there's no woman preparing food or making clothing or anything like that. That's completely absent from this book so far anyway.
Yeah.
Whereas a novelist like Margaret Atwood will describe as a very critical part of her.
That's the key.
Plot. The room in which the heroine has been commanded to live and the artifacts that are there to keep her safe.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize as she's discussing this environment about safety, that the safety is not to keep her safe from an outside force, but to prevent her from committing suicide. And you realize, oh my God, she's in this space. She's imprisoned in this space, but she's also imprisoned in all kinds of ways because so many before her have found freedom by ending their lives. So the environment that she's in, and little details like that, one of the things that's really important to her in this book is that she have hand cream to keep her hands soft, is an important thing to her.
Mm-hmm.
Just from the standpoint of feeling civilized, that she does not feel like a work drone. She has soft hands. So, you know, these kind of things add to very critically to the plot of the story.
Uh-huh.
Whereas an Asimov, these two guys talking to one another about, you know, I hate to say it, it's Dido and everything's Dido and Aeneas all over again. That's what it is.
It's two disembodied heads.
It is. It's with Dido and Aeneas, you know, we had this big argument in freshman humanities class about was Aeneas, did Aeneas do the right thing in abandoning Dido to the cave? Oh, yeah. And all the young men in the room said, yeah, he had to go off and found Rome. Are you kidding me? Of course they did. And all the women in the group said, Aeneas was a prick. He should have been there for Dido and not let her commit suicide. That's terrible. What an asshole.
Well, and
he had to go found Rome.
And in, you know, in philosophy, especially older, much older philosophy, there's a tradition of the dialectic, the dialogue. Not the dialect, but the dialogue, the sort of disembodied dialogue between archetypes about issues.
Yeah.
And there's no need to defend Isaac Asimov, but and I'm not going to defend Isaac Asimov. I will say that.
Oh, what's good for you?
Well, exactly. I know where who's making my salad tonight. Me, actually. But the point being, this actually might be an interesting thing at some point for you and I to expand to the writer's workshop.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because Asimov and Margaret Atwood are both really good writers.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the case of the Foundation stories, the frame of the story is there's this inevitable sweep of history that these people have been put in place to sort of navigate like a whitewater raft.
Yeah.
The story is the inevitability of each event.
Yeah, and he does it very efficiently.
And that these people who are swept along by things that are going to have a certain outcome no matter what they do. And the trick of the story is, well, this certainly couldn't have been foreseen. Mm-hmm. Therefore, there might be a crisis, or people have gotten, you know, kind of lazy and arrogant about the fact that their fate is in the hands of you know, they're special, they're chosen. And so household details are shed, are left behind in this sort of sweep of the story. And Margaret Atwood does her assessment of small details, because hers is a character-driven story, first of all. And secondly, it's that constant weighing of things. Every word has to do some work.
Right, right.
And so every writer, and this is part of the problem with blogging, especially with me, is I don't have an editor, so I can just write as long as I want. I could be I could be Michael Douglas in Wonder Boys and have, you know, a 3,000-page post because I couldn't stop. But if you're a decent writer, at some point every word has to pay its own way, and so you trade off what you cut and cut down to what you need. I'm assuming Margaret Atwood cut down to what she needed, and what she came up with was hand cream. And Asimov cut down to what he needed, and it was blasters.
Yeah.
And two guys talking.
Yeah.
But that's what is so pleasurable about a genre of fiction, is you really can savor the story, even though it's radically different from the next story you're going to read or the last story you read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as long as you're in the hands of a good writer, you're in good shape.
Amen.
Yeah.
Very good. All right. Well, let's talk for 15 minutes.
All right.
At least until we get to Daily Show.
All right.
it's almost 10 o'clock here on a Wednesday night. So
yeah, we got kids coming back.
We got kids coming back soon. Yeah, this week. So they'll be back, and we'll be podcasting around them. So that'll be fun. It'll be good to have them home.